Tenakoto, tenakoto, tenakoto katoa. Good evening to all, and welcome to this public lecture, made possible by the generosity of both Professor Chua Beng Huat, who comes to us from the National University of Singapore, and the Asian Migrations Research Theme at the University of Otago, who made this visit possible. Let me say a few words about the research theme itself. The Asian Migrations Theme is an interdisciplinary research collective that engages with the fields of diaspora, intercultural, global, and transnational studies, whose goal is to develop a theoretical and methodological framework for understanding the Asia-Pacific region as comprised by movements of people, ideas, and commodities. In that regard, it is fitting that we have Professor Chua Beng Huat, our speaker for today, who is a renowned scholar and commentator on the complex and heterogeneous social, cultural, and political terrain that is Asia. Professor Chua is concurrently Provost Professor in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences, Research Leader of the Cultural Studies in Asia Research Cluster at the Asia Research Institute, an internationally renowned research center for scholarship on Asia, and as well as being the Head of Department of Sociology at the National University of Singapore. Quite busy by all regards then. He has held visiting professorships at universities in the US, Malaysia, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Germany, and Australia, and was notably the inaugural Distinguished Visiting Scholar at the Carolina Asia Center at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, USA. Professor Chua's research interests include housing and urban policies, comparative politics of Southeast Asia, cultural studies in Asia, and East Asian pop culture. Further to this, he is a regular commentator on public issues in Singapore. His publications as author include Communitarian Ideology and Democracy in Singapore, Political Legitimacy and Housing, Stakeholding in Singapore, Life is Not Complete Without Shopping, a wonderful title, I should say, and most recently, Structure, Audience, and Soft Power in East Asian Pop Culture. As editor, he has published the following: Singapore Studies 2, Critical Survey of the Humanities and Social Sciences, Consumption in Asia, Lifestyle and Identities, Communitarian Politics in Asia, and Elections as Popular Culture in Asia. Elections as Popular Culture in Asia. And as co-editor, he has published the well-regarded and foundational text, Inter-Asia Cultural Studies Reader, East Asia Pop Culture, Analyzing the Korean Wave, and most recently, Port Cities in Asia and Europe. He is also founding co-executive editor of the journal Inter-Asia Cultural Studies, a key forum that has led to the dissemination and expansion of cultural studies in Asia. I have, of course, not added to this list the numerous journal articles, book chapters, and critical commentaries that Beng Huat has authored. They are too numerous to list here. Suffice to say that these contributions have had a significant impact not only on the scholarly fields of Asian studies, cultural studies, sociology, and postcolonial studies, but more importantly in the domain of public life itself, in Singapore specifically and Southeast Asia more generally. He's currently completing his single-authored book, tentatively titled, If the Publishers Agree, Disrupting Liberalism. Before I hand over to Professor Chua, I would like to extend my thanks and appreciation to the following people who have been instrumental in making sure the events for today and the next two events that we have organized proceed seamlessly. First, to Tui Clary, Research Assistant to the Asian Migrations Research Theme, for arranging the publicity, materials, the masterclass, and roundtable itself, and for organizing the venues and caterings. To Maureen Lloyd, Administrator of the Department of Media, Film, and Communication, for organizing Professor Chua's travel accommodation, and for providing overall administrative support to the three events. Similarly, my thanks goes to Paulette Mills, Administrative Assistant in the Department of Media, Film, and Communication, for preparing materials related to the three events that we are putting up while Professor Chua's here. And to Liz Lemus, Administrator of the Department of English, for providing support and organizing the events and finances. And finally, and I mean it, my thanks to all of you for making the time to attend today's talk, which is entitled Managing Multiculturalism, Immigration, Population Policy, and Citizenship. So could we please warmly welcome Professor Chua Beng Huat.
Thank you, Vijay. First, let me say it is a real honor to be here, to be doing this public lecture. And I want to thank the Asian Migration Theme members and Vijay for making this possible, and Maureen for my keep constantly changing my plans of my travel, and that she had to keep adjusting it accordingly. Thank you. Okay, so this is the theme that I'm working on. It is actually going to be part of this book that Vijay just mentioned on disrupting liberalism, lessons from Asia. The reason, let me just explain the title a little bit. My concern has been that in the current sort of global discussion about politics, the American version of liberalism has become globally hegemonic. It has become so much so that nobody writing in politics these days could ever imagine a democracy that is not liberal. So that by now, the general discussion conceptually, the two terms, liberalism and democracy, always go together as if they were conjugated permanently as liberal democracy, as if this was naturally the case. And it was not that long ago, somewhere around, say, 1950s and 60s, that liberalism and that fundamental contradictions between liberalism and democracy were still in the debate. So the very much sort of liberal democracy as a kind of the nature of things really is a development sort of post-1960s. And in the last 20 years or so, particularly post-Cold War, has become more and more hegemonic globally. And also, increasingly, it has also become sort of part of this hegemonic tendency is in the language of human rights, because that's very much, as you know, the UN Human Rights Code was very much American influenced, since the major writer was Madame Roosevelt. If you look at the Human Rights Code, it actually picks up a lot of the American constitutional language. The problem, of course, is that large part of Asia, almost all of Asia, I would say, does not have this long liberal tradition. All of Asian nations are either post-colonial and also concurrently post-Second World War. If you remember, essentially Asia, the idea of nation is a relatively new idea in Asia. And even China and Japan, as you know, China went from dynastic state to a very brief history of republicanism and then into communism. And in Japan, it was an imperial state until its defeat in the Second World War. And for the rest, they're all post-colonial new nations. As post-colonial nations, then the idea of nation is still very central to the development, to the political development in the region. And so there is this, also, the idea of democracy is relatively new to the region, and a lot of areas are still working out the rules of democracy. So given the Asian context, which is why I'm trying, which explains the title, that if liberalism was going to be disrupted, it would likely come from Asia, partly because also the reason from Asia rather than, say, Africa or Latin America is because Asia has also become the rising capitalist region of the world. So you can see that even with capitalism, the idea of individualism is not automatically linked. So I'm trying to kind of look at the experience of Asia as a mode of development of the future in which one might rethink an alternative politics, so to speak. So multiculturalism is one of the chapters in which I'm one of the substantive chapters of the book that I'm working on right now. So my concern today is to reflect on two different modes of managing multiculturalism in a settler nation, right, with multi-ethnic and multi-racial population. I'm going to use the word race rather than ethnicity, because in a lot of ways, ethnicity is simply a polite word to hide the word race rather than anything else. It doesn't make race and racism go away. It simply sounds more polite. So I'm not going to be polite. I'm just going to use the term race as it is. A multiracial population who are either first-generation immigrants or descendants of migrants. So I think New Zealand, Singapore are examples of settler nations, so I don't have to sort of go into explanation of what settler nation is. Although, as I understand it, New Zealand does not have an official multicultural policy. But the fact that you do have a multi-ethnic population would necessitate some modes of managing multiculturalism. So too is the U.S., and this is quite interesting because U.S. actually does not have an official multicultural policy. But I will characterize the difference between, Singapore mode of multiculturalism management and generally multiculturalism in the West as between what I would call state multiculturalism of Singapore versus liberal multiculturalism of all the other settlements in the West, including Canada, US, Australia, and perhaps New Zealand. I just know I was reading the newspaper, so in the last couple of days, and there seemed to be some kind of controversy about racism in New Zealand right now because the appointment of some race relations commissioner, I was told, is the wrong person in the right place, so to speak. So in the Western cases, Canada and Australia have explicit multiculturalism policy. I actually did my PhD on Canadian multiculturalism. In the case where there are no official multiculturalism, cultural rights are subsumed as individual rights, which guarantees freedom to one's own cultural practices and beliefs. So even in places like US and in New Zealand, the idea is that individuals have the rights to practice their culture, their own culture and beliefs, and that's guaranteed under basic freedoms. Now, that's actually fairly interesting because the reason why that is the case also is because within liberalism, groups cannot have rights because rights are all individually written. So even in a case where Australia and Canada, where there are multicultural policies, it's still very difficult to conceptualize what is group rights, right? So that's that's central to the difference between what I call state multiculturalism and liberal multiculturalism. There are three salient points to the difference. One is within liberal multiculturalism, it's difficult to conceptualize group rights because in liberalism, only individual bears rights. And the individual rights are constitutionally protected. Whereas in state multiculturalism, cultural rights of racial groups are explicitly and constitutionally guaranteed. Right. The second difference is within liberal multiculturalism, membership in and exit from the racial group is largely voluntary, even if one were to be born into the group. Even if race or ethnicity is ascribed within liberal multiculturalism, you still have the right not to belong and insist on not being a member, right? So, because it is entirely voluntaristic. This is actually very fundamental because I was once in a discussion where a philosopher of liberalism basically said, and this is even if it doesn't get done, but it is logically possible, was to say that when a person on the birthday of coming of age, of becoming an adult, whether it's 18 or 21, at the dinner table to celebrate birthday, he or she could basically say, okay, now I'm an individual with all my rights. The fact that I am part of this family is completely incidental. I owe no obligation to anybody at this table from now on. Right? I imagine this is seldom said in any family, in any situation, but it is in principle permissible. Right? This is unthinkable in a Chinese or an Indian family, of course, or even a Muslim family. But instead, multiculturalism, it is recognized that membership in a racial group is ascribed, and exit of individual from the ascribed status is not always permissible. Sometimes it is, exceptionally. But most of the time, you are racialized at birth, and it's not an option. Thirdly, within liberal multiculturalism, it is assumed that in practice, all cultural differences are respected and negotiable. The most important term is negotiable. With the highest development being what we now actually have elevated in value called societal civic cosmopolitanism. I mean, this word, of course, is now very popular. So it's like everybody wants to be cosmopolitan. There's a really fundamental problem with being so-called cosmopolitanism. Is essentially there's no commitment to any actually set of values other than being open and willing to negotiate everything, right? Instead, multiculturalism, the assumption is that cultural differences are not always negotiable and explicit boundaries of engagement or disengagement are specified. And I think, so I will come to this later, that the problem with liberal multiculturalism is that because it assumes everything is all are negotiable, when it confronts some set of values, a particular groups of people for whom certain basic values are non-negotiable, then there is no out. And it becomes a problem of conflict. I'll focus my presentation on state capitalism of Singapore and leave the liberal multiculturalism as a kind of implicit background reference because I think you can draw the comparison on your own, and we'll keep that for discussion purposes. And I'll be using Singaporean policies as illustrative of the difference. Right. So just a bit of historical background of why Singapore chose state multiculturalism at the very outset of nation. Of independent nation state. Singapore, I think Singapore was the very first nation that declared itself constitutionally a multiracial nation. Now, most of you who are political scientists would know that this is quite exceptional because it's the European definition of the nation state is that the state and the nation are coextensive, then you usually assume an homogeneous ethnic group and the nation is homogeneously so. And then everybody else is then minority groups endowed with rights of different kind. But in Singapore, it is explicitly constitutionally multinational. And this has to do with, at the time of political independence, right, there was really a necessity and not a choice. I mean, a lot of times the policies in Singapore are by necessity, not by virtue. Right? But of course, there's a tendency over time to turn necessity into virtue, which is, you know, standard sort of ideological moves that government made. First, unlike Australia, New Zealand, Canada, or the United States, the establishment of settlement in Singapore, here's sort of different ways of why Singapore became what it is historically, right? So against all, you know, unlike all these other nations, Singapore did not involve, in the colonization of Singapore, the settlement of Singapore did not involve massive destruction of indigenous population and cultures. So the Malays, which are constitutionally recognized as the indigenous population of Singapore, is in fact, while they are the Malays were in fact indigenous to Southeast Asia island archipelago region, but they were themselves migrants from the neighboring islands who settled in Singapore after the arrival of Raffles, after he had set up the trading post. So in fact, they were indigenous, they were recognized as indigenous because of regional politics. But they were not indigenous to Singapore Island. The second difference is that the majority population of Singapore as an independent nation was not the descendants of the colonizing white race, but another group of Asians, namely ethnic Chinese, who were also migrants and therefore had no proprietary claim to the land. They were just as foreign as the Malay population. The Chinese majority could have established themselves as the nation and usurped for themselves the monopoly power of the state. However, the geopolitical conditions of the time during the Cold War would not have permitted such a social construction of a Chinese nation, because it would have been read at that time potentially as we say, the Third China, or effectively the front end of communism in Southeast Asia, and also of a Chinese nation in a Malay world, so that the geopolitical condition would actually make it very difficult for Singapore to establish itself as a nation. One of the happy things about, one of the important, would seldom explain this way, but occasionally Lee Kuan Yew in his sort of more generous moment would actually say that one reason why Singapore could prosper is because our neighbors leave us alone. And this is very important, because if you compare Singapore to Lebanon, this is actually what happened. Lebanon was doing very well on its own until the outside forces start to disturb the local balance, and each one start to finance different communities within Lebanon, the Christians and the Muslims and so on. So because the outside, because the neighbor relations would not leave Lebanon alone, Lebanon ended up in a very unstable situation for a long time. The fortunate thing is that when Singapore became independent, it was also the time in which Sukarno had collapsed and Suharto had taken over from Indonesia. And Sukarno, as you might know, had a very confrontational attitude towards the establishment of Singapore. If that had continued, then it would be difficult not to spend a lot of energy and time and money fending off the outside. So Suharto basically left Singapore alone, because soon after that they found a lot of oil wealth in Indonesia, and Indonesia was then focused on internal development rather than international politics. And of course, Malaysia could not give us any hard time, because we've already been kicked out of Malaysia. So it's something that's seriously regretted but cannot be said out loud, right? Because no country in the 20th century had automatically gave up the most prized part of its nation. It could only be done because Tunku Abdul Rahman was behaving like a prince, and it was his to give away land at will. He didn't even consult the Malaysian parliament before he signed the separation agreement. So those are fairly, you know, so that's just important, the fact that we were in the Malay world, and, you know, establishing a Chinese nation would not be looked upon kindly. So obviously, given those conditions, it was impossible to actually establish an ethnically homogeneous nation in the sort of European style. So given all of that, Singapore had to declare itself from the very outset as a constitutional multiracial nation. But unlike liberal multiculturalism, all racial groups, especially now we tend to think of the three visible groups, the ethnic Chinese, South Asians, which are predominantly Tamils, and therefore Tamil is, in Singaporean imagination, Indians means Tamils until fairly recently. Of course, we had quite actually a lot of Sri Lankan Tamils mixed into it with actually Indian Tamils. We also have Bangladeshis and Pakistanis and so on, but they were sort of basically homogenized out as Indians. So South Asians, predominantly Tamils, and of course the Malays. They are all equal in the eyes of the law, and the cultural rights of all three groups are guaranteed by law. That's the guarantee by law means that there are certain official practices that makes the boundary between the racial groups fairly rigid rather than porous. Now, so by guaranteeing cultural rights by law has obviously serious consequences in how the society is managed. Nevertheless, Malays are recognized as constitutionally the indigenous population of Singapore, and as a result of that, are guaranteed some special rights. I just want to read out two of these rights. Two of the rights, are, first of all, Malay Muslim family matters comes under the Sharia court, the Islamic court, right? So things like property, settlements, and so on are according to Muslim law. Malay women, however, are given a choice of marrying under Sharia law or civil law. They can choose either, but once they've made the choice, all the marriage and family decisions must be according to the choice made, right? So if they choose Islamic law, then divorce has a different consequence. If they choose civic law, then it's a quite different altogether. And the second difference is that Malay students, second sort of special rights is Malay students are entitled to free education up to the tertiary level. Essentially, children have free education or minimal sort of school fees up to high secondary school, up to junior college, except for university education. That's highly subsidized but not free, except for Malay students. Malay students are free up to tertiary level. However, in view of a rising Malay middle class, the children of the middle class are required to pay tertiary education fees, but the money is paid towards a community, Muslim community fund, rather than to the university. Then the government reimburses the university for the fees itself. So those are the two very... a third important consideration is that the government itself helps the Malay community to develop mosques. There's a mosque building fund that is actually managed, and the government provides, make sure that there is a significant, a piece of land in a significant location within public housing estates that is reserved for Malay mosque building, and actually help to finance the initial financing of the mortgaging of the construction. So that's another important, so that Islam as a religion gets a lot of assistance from the government to stay not just viable, but quite vibrant. So such special provisions are not uncommon, but the special provisions are not uncommon in countries with official multiculturalism. For example, in Canada, it's very explicit, a bilingual nation, where English and French are the two national languages. In spite of the multicultural policy, it was stated the Royal Commission was actually called the Bilingualism and Multicultural Commission. And the two languages, English and French, are privileged in recognition of the two colonizing powers of Canada. And Quebec, being the French Canadian province, also enjoyed relative autonomy in language and cultural policies from the federal government. And belatedly, the Native Indians are now also given special rights, land rights and other forms of rights, who have now called themselves the First Nation. Okay, so Singapore, the background to Singapore being officially, constitutionally multicultural is important to remember. Under state multiculturalism, race is very much foregrounded in very explicit policy. So there is no sort of hidden racism or too polite to talk about race. Race is talked about all the time in Singapore because it's very much in the foreground. Everyone is racialized at birth, as I say. Every child is inscribed with the father's race and registered accordingly. Everyone is considered to be an inheritor and transmitter of their respective race culture, and this is reinforced by compulsory education for every primary and secondary school student in his or her respective ethnic language as a second language. The first language is in English, but every child must take a second language, which is the language of the father, in spite of it being called the mother tongue language. Right? So the mother tongue language is really misleading. And that's because it assumes that father and mother are from the same race, which is not always the case. But when there is a mixed race, it is still called it's the father's language that is being taught. So officially then, ethnic languages like Mandarin, Malay, and Tamil are part of the official languages, including English. So there are four official languages, of which Malay is the national language, but nobody speaks it other than the Malays. And it's not compulsory to learn, which caused a bit of embarrassment that you say your national language is Malay, but you can't speak it. You sing the national anthem in Malay, but you don't know what it means. So it's a bit embarrassing to do that. But now, increasingly, with more and more Indian migrants or South Asian migrants from South Asia, in addition to Tamil, there are other languages in Indian. Indian languages have become recognized, which includes Bengali, Hindi, Urdu, Punjabi, and soon Telugu will probably be included, right? So all these Indian languages are also now acceptable as mother tongue languages. It used to be, the second languages is actually taken with great importance because it used to be failing grades in the mother tongue in school would in fact have very severe consequences because you are denied admission to local universities. So if you fail Mandarin, up to about early 80s, if you fail Mandarin, you actually, or Indian, or Tamil, or Malay, you actually will not be admitted to the National University of Singapore. All right. And this has very serious consequences because there's a lot of families whose domestic language becomes increasingly English, and learning Mandarin kills them, or Tamil. It's not exactly easy language to learn. But progressively, because of the hardship on these children, the significance of second or mother tongue language has been sort of relaxed. So that over the years, second language criteria still makes a difference, but it is no longer determining in admission to the university. As religion and race are often coextensive, the two are often collapsed together sometimes separated, but sometimes collapsed together. For example, all Malays are constitutionally Muslims. Malays cannot be anything but Muslims. If a person converts out of Islam into some other religion, it's psychologically traumatic, not only for the person, but when it is known, essentially, there's a very heavy sanction, and usually the community, the people if they are students, for example, other students will hound them and continuously talk to them about conversion. So usually conversion is kept secret among Malays, and it's psychologically very difficult to manage. We often occasionally have Malay students in the university who has to be counseled on account of their conversion. The easiest to convert, so the law disallows Christians to spread their religion among Muslims. If that happens, potentially, it hasn't happened, but potentially the person who tries to convert a Muslim person could be charged for sedition, for disrupting public peace. Right? Generally, they're just told to stop, and they have to, if they persist, they could be criminalized. So that's what I mean by state multiculturalism, where the preservation of group rights is seriously policed. And each race religion is publicly recognized because the national holidays are divided accordingly. Two festivals of each religion are recognized as official holidays, including Christmas and Good Friday for Christians, which are racially mixed. But there's Muslim holidays and Hindu and Buddhist holidays. Some of those holidays are kind of mixed up, right? Because Buddhism is both Indian and Chinese. Christmas is Indian, Chinese, and others, except for the Malays that are being excluded. So equally, so all the public holidays are somewhat tied, not all, but most of them are tied to religion or race, including 2 days of Chinese New Year. And the only public holidays that are not religious or Chinese or race-based is National Day and May 1st, Labor Day, right? Everything else is, all the other 9 holidays are tied to race as well. So in politics, those are in culture. In politics, to ensure minority racial groups are represented proportionally in parliament, there is what we call a group representative constituency, where 4 or 5 different constituencies are grouped together as a bigger constituency. Every contesting political party must run a whole slate of candidates, among whom must be a minority member, so that within parliament, 25% of parliamentarians must be non-Chinese, proportion to their presence in the society. So all these are actually conditions of constraint that are explicitly the consequence of being constitutionally multiracial, right? And this, of course, if you just think about it, this would be almost all of it will be acceptable in a liberal democracy, because they are all exceptions from liberal democracy, because they actually, in every instance, constrains the rights of the individual. So as a result of this sort of emphasis on multiracialism, racial harmony is elevated as a public good, right? So racial harmony is a constant theme of government. Conceptually, the need for racial peace and racial harmony, it can be said to be both the cause and consequence of multiculturalism as state policy. Now, again, there's a lot of historical background, which, given the time, I would sort of skip. But so all the guarantees of cultural rights of racial groups is aimed at producing racial peace as a general social condition. One could say that racial harmony has become elevated to the level of public good in Singapore. And like all public goods, it requires government investment. The government does not expect racial harmony to be a natural outcome of daily interaction of the different races, although it is in fact the case in Singapore that at the everyday life level, there's a lot of interaction that goes on without much event or conflict. But the government actually explicitly, the government actually thinks that racial peace and racial harmony is a product that has to be engendered by explicit social policies, by active promotion, and most importantly, by policing and intervening, if necessary, the boundaries and contact points between race and religion. Right? So, for example, as I already said, Christians are disallowed to proselytize among Muslims. And any Christian pastor who sort of casts disparaging remarks on any other religion would actually be told publicly to stop. And with internet, this happens quite frequently now. And increasingly, the government does not even have to intervene because the public will actually get on the internet and expose such disparaging remarks, especially if they're posted on Facebook or YouTube, and they will basically publicly apologize and stop doing so. So it's become self-policing rather than state intervention. As much as race is explicitly foregrounded in public policies, racial harmony as a public good is constantly, prominently on display in Singapore, both as a reminder of its importance and actually as a national achievement. Right? So Singapore, both the government and the people, are quite proud of the fact that they are really living in religious harmony. So you can see in the everyday life, just give you a couple of examples of how this works away from sort of state sponsorship and state policing. Racial and religious harmony can be seen in the juxtaposition of religious institutions, and since religion and race are coextensive, right? What is interesting is you could see a mosque next to a church, there's no problem, or a Chinese temple next to a Hindu temple. And the most interesting is Chinese temple and Hindu temple because those two religions are polytheistic. They don't have jealous gods. They share a lot of gods. And as a result of that, you see these Chinese women devotees going into Hindu temples and wave incense sticks around, which they are not allowed to do as a Hindu. I mean, a Hindu person, in Hinduism, only the priest is allowed to handle the incense. So you've got all these Chinese women running around doing all this until they figure out a way of containing this, which is to put a huge Chinese brass urn for incense holder outside the temple. So the woman would then, use their incense and put it outside and walk inside. Then they will go into a Hindu temple and listen to all these chants that goes on that they don't understand at all. But they sit politely in the back behind the Hindu worshippers and sit through the entire ritual. So it's quite interesting. Beyond that, there is now even further integration that the Chinese temples and Hindu temples sometimes share the same building. And whereas it's kind of internally partitioned off, one side is Hindu and one side is Chinese Buddhism, Chinese religion. And they share the same management board. So they manage the finances as a one unit, right? And of course, in food, there's obviously a lot of borrowing. I mean, most Singaporean Chinese are from the south by inheritance, who does not eat chili. But Singaporean Chinese are extremely sophisticated in chili eating. I once argued that a Singaporean Chinese identity, you could tell they're Chinese or Malaysians by the fussiness of chili. Because if you go to what we call a hawker center, every food comes with different chili. If the wrong chili, it's just not acceptable. All right, it's either vinaigrette, with ginger, without ginger, freshly cut chili padi, with dark soy sauce, light soy sauce, green, red. You don't eat wonton mein with red chili vinaigrette. You don't eat chicken rice with green chili. So if you order six different dishes, the whole table will be covered with chili dips. that nobody else knows why, but you know, if you're Malaysian in Singapore, that's absolutely essential, right? Now, so over the past 50 years then, Singaporeans have come readily to believe that they do live in a multicultural society in racial harmony. And this is, as I say, both nationally and individually taken as a serious achievement. Now, obviously, execution of the various race culture based public policies and the policing of racial peace at the societal level extract high costs from individuals. And this is easily demonstrated by the tie-up between performance in second language, as I said earlier, and university admission, right? Another measure to supposedly preempt racial conflict is the allocation of public housing. Public housing is allocated according to racial quota, up to every block. So each block must have approximately 75% to 80% percent Chinese only, and then so many percent Indian, so many percent Malays. And this actually caused quite a lot of difficulties, particularly for Malays and Indians, because they are unable to sell their flat to a Chinese person if the quota is already filled. And usually the Chinese person is able to pay a higher price for the flat than a Malay or Indian. So there is actually a fairly serious financial cost in this quota system. So in all of this and other instances where there is a conflict between individual interests and public policy, it is always the public policy that prevails rather than individual rights that prevail, individual interests that prevail. So I would say in practice, the preservation of group race culture and group rights supersedes individual rights. This is the central difference between state multiculturalism and liberal culture multiculturalism. From a liberal multiculturalism point of view, an adult's membership in any group, including a racial group in which one is born, is entirely based on self-determination and entirely on one's own volition. One is not obliged to abide by any of the demands of the group's cultural practices unless one voluntarily chooses to do so. Consequently, when the claims of the group and community are in conflict with one's interests and exceeds the price one is willing to pay, then one can easily exit from the group and suffer no legal repercussion. Membership in a group is therefore highly instrumental, right? And so this creates a kind of free rider instance. I mean, I'm a member of this group as long as it pays me to do so. But once the cost of membership becomes too high, then I will think about exit and giving up the membership, right? Academically, this very instrumental attitude has now been conceptualized fairly cleverly as what is called strategic identity. Those of you who are familiar with this term, it comes from essentially Gayatri Spivak, and then now it becomes a popular term in cultural studies of race relations. The most consistently applied this term within your neighborhood is Yin Ang in Australia, who wrote a book called On Not Speaking Chinese, and why she is sometimes Chinese, sometimes not, by her own choosing, right? So the ethnic identity is one that can be taken off or cast aside depending on whether it is advantageous or disadvantageous in a particular context. So this is where cosmopolitanism becomes really slippery, right? Because you kind of allow yourself to be everything to everybody or nothing to no one if it comes into conflict of your self-interest. So such an attitude actually not only shows no commitment to the group, but engenders a kind of, you know, free rider who takes temporary membership whenever it's advantageous without paying the cost of membership. And I had written a paper called Cost of Membership. Indeed, the idea of strategic identity is a cynical attitude that is all too aware of the cost of involuntary ascribed membership in any racial groups. This is often couched in the language of modernity and tradition, Tradition is rightly understood as constraints on individual preferences and behavior as it prescribes certain normative behavior. So, for example, in the case of Muslims and Malays, the division of objects and behaviors as between halal, being religiously acceptable, and haram, being not religiously acceptable or sinful, right? So such constraints are counter to the modernist attitude that emphasizes the sovereignty of individuals in exercising rational choice. Little wonder that strategic identity is a position largely subscribed by the better educated, who are all too aware of how difficult it is, in fact, to live up to the demands of maintaining a cultural tradition. Just like me, I often say I'm not Chinese, because I think being Chinese is culturally hugely difficult. So the liberal position is further reinforced by an assumption of not only tolerance and negotiability of difference that will generate mutual understanding, but at its most critical, this stance signifies an absence of strongly held values among liberals. In practice, this belief becomes inoperable when it confronts cultural groups who hold that some of their values are so fundamental and non-negotiable. So faced with such confrontation, right, it either ends up in a deadlock or at worst, it becomes a cause for violence. Obviously, the idea of strategic identity and its corresponding attitude unavoidably destabilizes and erodes the integrity and continuity of the group, because the group must be able to count on its members individually and collectively to be willing to sacrifice certain abstract or even material interests for the preservation of the group itself. And the interesting thing is that very often, liberals like me, sometimes, I was actually scolded for being liberal by no other than Lee Kuan Yew himself, publicly for being too liberal. But in any case, the interesting thing is that this position of the educated is not replicated in generally, just for want of a better term, the masses. Because very often we will... I would call the vernacular point of view rather than the educated point of view, okay? From a vernacular point of view, the idea that an individual is always part of a larger social unit and therefore obligated to orient oneself, responsibly to coordinate activities with others and meet the needs of others as part of meeting one's own is always taken for granted, right? So in the vernacular sense, people always are actually part of the social group. They are never individuals. In fact, that the fact that they are part of the social group is taken for granted. So that the fact that one is part of a larger social unit, including a racial group, is commonsensical, uncontroversial, and without doubt. That in reality, one only come to face-to-face interaction with a limited number of the larger units. So this idea that the community is imagined, right, is really not very important, right, in this taken-for-grantedness. From the everyday taken-for-granted conceptualization of community, the liberal insistence of an unencumbered individual is not only unnatural but fictitious intellectual sophistry or intellectual cunning. The everyday attitude of identity is at a great distance from the idea of strategic identity. One's identity is not an empty vessel to be filled whenever convenient. The identity of a person is derived from being embedded and bound by the cultural practices of the community in which they reside and which constitute for the person who he or she is, and realized in and through the reproduction of everyday life. So I would say that the Singaporean state multiculturalism may be said to be grounded in precisely this vernacular understanding of social life. The consequence as I mentioned earlier, state multiculturalism extracts a certain cost from the citizens. Once you are, you are marked by racial category from the start, every individual is then inscribed a certain culture and expected to subject oneself to its obligation. Meanwhile, the state maintains a set of public policies that are aimed at maintaining racial peace. And here, the state itself, and here's the politically interesting, because here, the state itself sets itself up structurally as above the racial groups. So the state sees itself as this neutral empire that adjudicates disputes that arise among the group, right? In this management of race, occasions of necessary disadvantaging one group for the sake of racial harmony are not only not avoided, but in fact become part of policy, as I had already mentioned earlier, right? And this has a cost not only on minority, but also on the majority. For example, the Chinese majority is constrained to accept that their language is just one of four languages and is not able to demand that their language becomes elevated to the level of national language. Right? And most importantly, ironically, race then becomes, useless as a potential base for political organization. Even though you can, because the government will not allow race-based political organizations. Right? All race-based organizations are community self-help organizations. They are not allowed. All political parties in Singapore are multiracial rather than strictly race-based. And the group constituency that I talked about earlier guarantees the minority representation, but never allowing that to become politicized into a kind of race conflict. So all the racial policies basically act in concert to ensure and reinforce cultural continuity of the racial groups. What is most important achievement in this particular case is that it gives the racial groups themselves a very strong sense of cultural security, so that no one feels threatened that their culture is going to be eroded by the majority population, right? And this sense of security is actually, although it's one of those immaterial realities that is very difficult to actually pin down, but is fundamental to the reproduction of social harmony in the nation. And I think that is the value of state multiculturalism. So you don't actually get to a point in which, as I say, where fundamental values are non-negotiable, then it becomes a source of conflict. Because no one particularly doesn't feel threatened. And I think this is really interesting because we often ask politicians, Singaporean educated very often ask the politicians, why don't you remove race because this is really archaic and all that? Why do you racialize everyone? And the answer always is, For educated people like you, race is not important because the achievement lies somewhere else. But for the masses of the population, ethnic identity is central to their sense of being, central to their subjectivity. And so it will not be removed. And it's very important to recognize that kind of cultural continuity and cultural security is an achievement of this situation, right? Okay, so that's basically what I want to say. The question is always raised, sort of switching gear a bit, the question is always raised about multiculturalism and nation. So that a lot of the, both left and right wing of the debate tend to argue that multiculturalism dilutes nationalism. This is obviously true in Europe, where in 1 week, three of the most important European prime ministers and declare multiculturalism to be unworkable and dead. David Cameron, Angela Merkel, and the past president Sarkozy, all of them declared that multiculturalism is unworkable in their nation because they confront Islam. Right? If there wasn't Islam, it would happily be liberal multiculturalists. So this question of multiculturalism and nation needs to be raised, because the argument is that multiculturalism potentially erodes any identification with the nation state, because it intensifies separateness of ethnic identities. Right? Now, with attention fully focused on economic development, the Singapore government had acted very quickly to actually, in the last year or so, I want to talk about how nationalism has emerged in Singapore in the last little while by looking at migration and population policy in Singapore that provides some empirical evidence of the connection between multiculturalism and nationalism, right? Since Singapore is very much focused on economic development, in the last while, it has actually brought in migrants with immigration with a vengeance. Within a period of about 7 years, it had 1 million people to the island, which is huge, right? The result is an outcry of Singaporean citizens against the government policy of hyper-economic growth without consideration of the living conditions of the citizens. So, unfortunately, this has resulted in the emergence of what some people will call xenophobia among Singaporeans for the first time. Singapore is a very open country. We live with foreigners all the time. I mean, it's never been otherwise. But suddenly there's this new anti-foreign attitude because of the volume, and it's really difficult to handle, right? As a result, there's a huge outcry, and not only that, it affected the popular support, electoral support of the ruling party in the 2011 election. The government fairly quickly corrected its policies and reduced immigration rate from 17% to about 4 or 5%. And now it's actually very difficult to there's continuing constraint on bringing in foreign workers, right? So obviously the citizens' anger is really towards the government economic policy that has translated into this anti-migration, anti-immigrant flow. And what is ironic is that, in fact, in some sense, it is the first time that you see a Singaporean nationalism emerging, because it is now citizens over others. Because within that anti-immigrant policies is the local Chinese against new arrival Chinese, local Indians against new Indians, local Malays against new Malays, and not actually across racial lines. There's an elevation of the value of citizenship over race for the first time visible, right? So in that sense, I mean, I would argue that there is no necessary contradiction or inherent contradiction between multiculturalism as practice and the rise of nationalism as such. Right, so this sort of, you know, race is really not the important issue. And basically, that's where the sort of issue now rests, and the Singaporeans continue to understand the need for new immigration, because the economy wouldn't run otherwise. But at the same time, there's now pressure on the government to emphasize citizens' rights rather than just purely pursuing economic interests at all costs. Okay, I think I've already spoken for too long. Thank you very much.